With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle. Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast. Show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor, I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life.
So this is going to be a slightly unusual podcast in that it's just me talking. It's going to be me being as open and honest as possible, talking about my learnings from 2020, what's happened to me this year, my personal experiences, and hopefully by sharing and probably oversharing as well, you will get a snippet of information or a snippet of knowledge that helps you. And even if it's just one bit, then I'm super happy with that. Broadly speaking, I'm going to be talking about my tools for coping, what I've learnt, literally what I've learnt, particularly during my master's and the process of doing this podcast, and some broader topics as well about coping mechanisms and the way I feel people would benefit from doing a few activities that sound a little bit woo-woo, but actually are really evidence-based. And actually, I've, from personal experience and patient experience and colleague experience, it's very effective. So the things I'm going to be speaking about today include gratitude, living in the present. I'm also going to be talking about my learnings from my nutritional medicine master's and upon completing that, what I've learned and what my perspective of food has been and how that might have changed. What I've learned by doing this podcast this year in particular, I want to talk a little bit about inequality, how to live healthier and with purpose, the power of routine, as well as some books that I feel have had a huge impact on my morning routine, but also just generally how I think about things as well. And I also want to talk a bit about the aspirations for my personal New Year and how I kind of structure going into New Year's as well. And hopefully, you know, that is useful for anyone who's trying to do something in their own space, and it doesn't need to be nutrition or entrepreneurship. It can just be, you know, how they want to frame your year. Because if you don't go into a new year with intention, then you're sort of scrambling around. You always need to have a plan or a backup or a protocol. That's the way I like to approach things. And it's actually one of the mechanisms by which I feel that I've become a lot more productive over the years. So to start off with, and regular listeners to the podcast, as well as people who follow me on social media, will probably be pretty bored of me talking about gratitude. But gratitude is the antidote to suffering. It is the antidote to the apathy, to boredom, to, you know, it is a really important concept that takes practice. In the same way, going to the gym and working out and improving your personal best rowing time or running time, gratitude is an exercise that needs to be performed on a daily basis. And the three things that I'm grateful for at the end of the day is a practice that I've maintained for quite a few years now, even before I started sharing it on social media. And when I started sharing it on social media in 2017, you know, it was just meant to be 15 or 30 days of me sharing three things to encourage people at the start of the year to do the same sort of practice. And that led to, you know, me continuing that for years and years to come. And so the three things that I'm grateful for every single day can be as small as, you know, a nice comment from my boss at work, or the fact that I got a text from someone who I haven't spoken to in ages and they live in Australia, or, you know, I'm massively grateful for the technology that we have currently so we can stay connected. You know, it doesn't have to be a big thing every day, but it reminds me the next day and in that moment about just how lucky I am and how much privilege I have. The very virtue of being able to listen to a podcast is a huge privilege that a lot of people don't have. And so this kind of reframes my thinking on a daily basis, and it reframes the way I look at the world. And actually, my gratitude practice pre-2020 has been pivotal for me maintaining a perspective that is positive, that is content, that is, you know, pretty pleasant actually. And for all the ups and downs of this year, I've kind of maintained a consistent mood. I mean, obviously there are times where you lash out and you feel like you lose control, or you feel that you haven't had much control over how you're feeling in that moment, but the process of coming back to that content, to that middle way, that I feel has been massively aided by gratitude as a process for me. And I think it's also reminded us that tomorrow is not guaranteed, but today is. And that importance of trying to achieve happiness in the present moment rather than wishing for something to happen in the future to allow happiness to thrive. And, you know, it can, to use a fickle analogy, when I get my Rolls Royce in 1 year's time, that's when I'll be happy. Or when I go on my holiday, or when I afford to go on a holiday that I want to go on in X amount of time, that's when I'll be happy. But actually, you want to be trying to achieve happiness in this moment right now, irrespective of whatever you achieve in the future. And I use some fickle examples. It's not necessarily fickle for everybody, because it's nice to have a goal to work towards. But achieving happiness in the present moment is what really leads and unlocks true contentment and true pleasure. And this is something that I've come to realize over the last few years. Going slightly off topic and going to my nutritional medicine, my nutritional medicine master's. So I completed that at the start of the year. It was a weird time because I was writing essays whilst I was helping out in ITU in the non-clinical role that I was doing, and in A&E. And so writing about topics such as obesity and sugar consumption, food addiction, you know, these, I've done 36 essays over the last year and a half, all to do with different topics around nutritional medicine, arthritis, IBD, ADHD, omega-3, selenium, you name it. We've done so many essays, and it's been a fascinating process trying to answer questions that I perhaps wouldn't have come up with myself, and being pulled into areas that I didn't feel that I had an interest in. And I think to talk about three key learnings of my nutritional medicine master's, would be a good place to start, because I don't want to regale everything that I've learned about from the last 2 years that I've been doing it, and I'm still yet to complete the project, which I'm going to talk about a bit later with my app. But my opinion of sugar has always been it's always been a pretty, I would say, middle ground, balanced and not really too vocal about, I would say. It's definitely not good for us. We definitely have way too much of it in our food system. We definitely overconsume on a daily basis, particularly in the UK and the States, but also growing in Middle Eastern areas and South Asia. But the extent to how dangerous I thought sugar was, perhaps was magnified by doing the cardiometabolic module, where we looked at the mechanism behind sugar's impact on inflammation, liver health, as well as brain health. And you've seen lots of headlines in the past about food being addictive, or food or sugar being as addictive as cocaine. And I always sort of thought of that as media overhype, but actually breaking it down into the addictive properties of sugar and how that marries up to the clinical definition of what addiction is, I was pretty shocked at how it kind of matches on perfectly. And you can refer to sugar as an addictive substance, as it demonstrates some clear objectives for it to be defined by: that tolerance, withdrawal effects, the danger of overconsumption, habitual overconsumption. It's pretty remarkable how the studies were suppressed as well a number of decades ago, and that's led to sugar being in our food system and being seen as pretty innocuous. Now, I'm not one of those people that would never use sugar or consume sugar ever again, like baking or, you know, adding some coconut sugar to a Thai curry. You know, I definitely think there are boundaries, and there's definitely a limit to which we can deal with, and we should include for the purposes of flavor and culinary aspects and making food a lot more palatable. But the degree to how much we overconsume and how much we overpromote through fast foods, convenience foods, and sugar sweetened beverages like Coke and all the other brands that you can think of, it's pretty horrifying when you learn a lot more about the mechanism behind sugar, and particularly its impact on children. I've just recorded a podcast with Professor Michael Goran and his colleague, who wrote a book all about sugar and kids, and that's coming out at the start of 2021. So definitely listen to that. But I was pretty shocked at how much of an impact sugar can have, particularly on children and developing young adults. So it's definitely one to watch, but that's one of the key learnings I've found from my nutritional medicine master's that really did bring it home. Another element, and it kind of goes without saying really, because we talk about it on the podcast so much, but it is the magnitude of effect of the microbiota, the population of microbes that live in and around our body, largely in our gut. And I'm going to do a whole series of podcasts on this, because it's definitely something you will refer to pretty much every podcast episode we do on nutrition. We know about the basic functions of the microbiota being an organ that digests food for us, releases micronutrients, creates neurotransmitters, is involved inherently in sugar balance, in inflammation balance. It's pretty incredible just how many different areas of medicine that the microbiota is involved in, and we're still learning a lot more. The premise of probiotics and other interventions of a similar light, where you introduce live bacteria, those are yet to be proven out, but the core sort of basics that most people don't get even today is fiber, prebiotic fibers in particular, onion, garlic, chicory, all the different sources of multiple fiber subtypes, as well as variety and diversity and largely plants. I mean, this is the key thing. And it's something that I speak about with patients all the time whenever I'm prescribing antibiotics. Probiotic foods, I think, are a bonus, and they're generally innocuous and potentially effective. But the core thing of fiber is really important. And I'm always on a journey of learning more about exactly how this works. And the third thing that I would say is, so there's sugar, there's fiber. The third thing that I wouldn't say I've changed my mind on, because I've definitely been a proponent of any diet that has therapeutic benefit. But there are two diets that I've sort of changed my mind on. One is the keto diet, and one is the very low calorie restricted diet. So the very low calorie diet. To tackle the first one, the keto diet, for those of you who have already listened to Sue Wood's podcast, where we talked at length about the keto diet, how it works, where it came from, and where the potential clinical applications are. I think it's a diet that definitely needs a lot more unpacking and definitely needs a lot more attention, particularly in the neurological community, because it is quite fascinating how the keto diet reduces the number of seizures in a certain subset of patients. The applications of that, given that we use anti-epileptic medications for a wide range of issues, including migraine, pain. There was also some psychological potential there as well for the keto diet. And cognitive benefits, you know, it definitely needs a lot more unpacking and a lot more attention. My concern is there are some people who are what are deemed hyper responders to fat, and particularly the type of fat that's included in keto diets. But there is a growing consensus that if you change the type of fats that are used in this very high fat diet, then you can mitigate against some of the potential cardiovascular risks. So the keto diet, I think, is a very interesting one. Not one that I would personally use, and neither one that I would recommend unless there were specific circumstances. However, the way the keto diet has been portrayed in the media as a fat loss element or a diet that everyone should try, I think it's incorrect. But I do think it definitely warrants a lot more attention from a scientific standpoint. And the very low calorie diet, that, for those of you who don't know, is a significantly calorie reduced diet that's given in a therapeutic manner to those suffering with type 2 diabetes. And the impact of that diet has been shown to be as effective as bariatric surgery, which, and for the and anyone who doesn't know about the potential side effects of bariatric surgery, I would encourage you to look it up, because it's not as simple as putting a band in or, you know, giving someone a bit of a dietitian attention and then performing the surgery. It's a huge procedure and with massive ramifications post-procedurally as well, from an absorption point of view, a vitamin point of view, a psychological point of view. There is a growing number of patients who have had this procedure and their risk of eating disorders. So it's not something that is taken lightly by the profession, and it's not something that we can use in a scalable manner to treat obesity and type 2 diabetes as a problem once it's established at scale. So we have to entertain different areas, and very, very, very low calorie diets are a very interesting area that I think would be appropriate for a lot of people once counseled, but it definitely takes time. But again, I wasn't in that mindset at all, that a very low calorie diet, a VLCD, would be useful. But it definitely takes a lot of psychological strength and support, I would say, for people doing that. The podcast for me in 2020 has been a source of comfort. It's allowed me to reach out to some incredible people, both medical and non-medical. So we've had psychologists, we've had nutrition lecturers, we've had friends of mine talking about everything from eye health, immune health. We talked a lot about the gut, as I mentioned. But I also used it to really reach out to people and think about how we can grow from what is a tragic situation of lockdown, of early death, of infection, morbidity, which is yet to come about, financial insecurity. And so I spoke to two people that I was privileged to speak with them in the first place. Professor Guy Standing, who has been a huge advocate for universal basic income, you know, UBI, as it's also known, is a concept where you give literally cash to people with no ramifications, no guidelines on how to spend it. You literally just give them cash every single month. And this cash, by virtue of being a citizen of the country, will allow them, should allow them, and should be enough to allow them to afford rent, to afford food, to afford to live. And this blanket of financial security has been shown in some studies, relatively small if you compare it to population size, but still pretty big studies in Finland and in parts of India, and there might be some others as well, but I'm not hugely well read up in this area. But to massively increase happiness levels, and I'm using happiness specifically rather than levels of literacy or levels of job attainment or anything else, because happiness is really the core feature of what we should be aiming for. And that brings me onto another podcast that I actually recorded in 2019 with Mike Viking, all about happiness and why happiness is really the goal. I'm going to be recording another podcast in early 2021 with Mo Gawdat, who is the former Google X CEO or CBO, and who tragically lost his son in a freak accident after having a routine appendectomy about 4 years ago. And he was working on the algorithm for happiness at Google at the time. And this was the ultimate test, losing his son, who was in his early 20s, so quickly and so unannounced. I mean, it was a complete shock. And going through the process of maintaining happiness, because his formula is all about perspective. If your perspective meets your expectations, then you can be happy. But when those are out of line, i.e. your expectations are much higher than your current perspective, I'm sure he'll say it better when we record the podcast, then that's what can lead to levels on happiness. So happiness as a measure of societal progress, and just rather than wealth alone, I think it's something that we need to really think about in 2021 from a political standpoint. I'm also going to be speaking to a number of different politicians or people in politics about this concept, because I think, yes, we can vote with our money, and yes, we can vote with our fork, but we do need to rely on the politicians and other elements of government to really guide our population and our country towards high levels of happiness, because that is kind of overshadowed. And I think it's overshadowed in government in the same way nutrition and lifestyle has been, you know, disregarded in medicine as something that is a bit woo, as something that is a bit fringe, whereas actually happiness is the true goal of what our politicians should be doing for us. They should be trying to maintain a country that allows happiness to thrive, that allows health to thrive, that allows well-being and financial security to thrive. And these are the things that we should be holding up as metrics, as markers of the success of the country. And it's something, again, that has been brought up by the pandemic. The other thing I want to talk about, and I don't want to talk about the pandemic in a literal sense, or you know, make this a political podcast, but the inequality that we see today that has been brought about as a result of the pandemic existed way before the pandemic. And I say existed as the result of the pandemic, it always existed, but it was kind of overcast. It was shadowed. It was tucked away in the corner. But the number of people using food banks, the number of people who are financially insecure, the number of people who are food insecure has been brought to our attention in a huge, huge light. Now, this is something that I was aware of quite a number of years ago. I mean, we've done culinary medicine now in the UK for the last 2 years, where we teach medical students the foundations of nutrition, as well as how to cook. And in that program, we also teach them about food insecurity, and we also teach them about the levels of poverty that exist in society today. And being in a privileged position of being a primary care physician, a GP, not only working in primary care but also in A&E, I see this at an anecdotal level. And when you marry what I see in clinic and in medicine to what the statistics say, you realize we're in a horrible situation and have been for a number of years prior to what we're seeing this year. The injustices, again, that have existed way before the pandemic were brought in a horrific light during the pandemic as well. But the persecution of religious groups, races, et cetera, all existed before the pandemic. And I think it's this realization that we need to sit with so we can actually become a better, more compassionate society going forward. And I know this sounds a bit like I'm on my high sort of moral horse here, but I think injustices and subconscious bias exist within all of us, even people from ethnic minorities like myself. We all are privy to having biases, prejudices that we need to get comfortable with ourselves before we can actually change them and admit to ourselves, if not publicly, that they exist within us and we need to work through those. And it's a very, very important practice to do with oneself. And I would highly recommend that you listen to some of the resources that myself and the team put together in the summer to really understand where this could be coming from and why this happens. There's a number of fantastic lectures by the historian Akala, A-K-A-L-A, that he performed in a number of locations. But one of the ones that I thought was perhaps the most thought-provoking was the lecture he gave at Oxford University, all about Black history. And for those of you who haven't watched it, I would highly recommend you watch that, because it really brought to home where subconscious bias and where prejudice actually originates from. And it's the media. And it's very, very stark when you realize when you realize just how insidious it is. And on that note of the pandemic and inequality, I just want to reiterate something that Jon Snow said a couple of weeks ago on a Channel 4 podcast. This is our third world war. And it's not a country or a group of countries. It is this invisible force that nobody really foresees, apart from perhaps the microbiologists and epidemiologists and virologists. But this is our third world war. And when you reframe it like that and you think about the levels of sacrifice, the levels of lack of communication during the First and Second World War, the levels of loss of life, we're doing a lot better, and we're a lot more comfortable than we were. It's still very, very uncomfortable, but we're definitely more comfortable than it was before. And I actually take a lot of solace in that. I'm in a very privileged position, being able to work on the front line, being privy to what comes out next, and understanding and having a level of understanding about epidemiology. However, I feel like a lot of us have access to information that we would not have had during previous world wars. And actually, you know, when you reframe it like that, I found that quite comforting. Okay, so on to some more positive aspects of the podcast. How to live healthier. So my perspective on food has really evolved over the last 5 or 6 years. When I first got ill with atrial fibrillation that I managed to overcome in 2011, what I thought was just my change in food and perhaps even my exercise regime that included a lot more yoga and Pilates and flow and stretch and mobility, as well as doing long distance running and strength training. You know, I thought that combined with food was one of the things that really helped me get through it. But actually, it was this concept of purpose and community, because I never gave up being a doctor, even though I was ill at the time. And I never wanted to sacrifice my goal of becoming a fully fledged doctor. And the community that I had around me of other medics, but also other people who were interested in nutrition, was exceptionally important when it came to me overcoming my medical issue. And so how to live healthier is a real interplay of six different concepts. It's yes, food and nutrition. Yes, it's exercise and sleep and meditation or mindfulness, call it what you will. But it also comes down to cultivating that purpose and having a community or being part of a community. And I look at this through the lens of food. And when I say this, I literally mean through the lens of food. Humor me for a moment. If you imagine in hunter-gatherer days where we would have foraged for food, or we would have hunted for food, we would have woken up really early in our community mud huts, or whatever you want to call them, tree huts. And we would have prepared our gear and we would have gone out into the wilderness. And during that long stretch of exercise, of walking along, we would have been completely still. We wouldn't have been chatting with our mates or anything like that. We would have just been still because, A, you want to make sure that you are aware of any predators, and B, you want to make sure that you're not scaring away any prey. And so that stillness that you had to cultivate, that sense of that concentration, that pure focus, is mindfulness in itself. And that walking, that carry on walking, that the flow of going across a plain, again, that exercise, and that is mindfulness in itself. We would have caught, hopefully, our prey or foraged or whatever, brought it back to the community. We would have eaten whatever we could find and whatever was seasonal and whatever we were able to carry back with us. And then we would have shared that within the community itself. And that communal act of sharing and eating food together, you know, that really does cultivate your purpose, because your purpose is to feed your family, your community, and to be part of this close-knit network. And you would have gone to sleep when the lights went out, because A, there's no electricity, and B, you need to wake up refreshed to do the same thing the next day. And so every element of lifestyle medicine, or call it whatever you want, is rooted in the search for food and the enjoyment of food and the sharing of food. These are the fundamental constructs of what we deem lifestyle medicine. And obviously it needs a bit of a rebrand, because we don't need to go out and hunt food anymore. But there is something in our evolutionary history that is so special about food, about breaking bread, about sharing food. It's almost intertwined in our DNA. And that is why I take so much interest in food. And I've realized this is sort of why we are so ingrained to love food, to smell food, to be attracted to the visual pleasure of a colorful bowl of food. It's because it's literally wired into us. And this is the foundational basis behind lifestyle medicine that, you know, I never want to forget about, because it's that beautiful entanglement of everything that I love to talk about and love to research. And on the note about how to live healthier, what I've noticed particularly this year is the power of routine. Wake, water, meditate. It's exactly what I've just done today. I'm recording this at 6:15 in the morning. Prior to this, I've woken, obviously. I've had a lot of water. I've taken the dog out and I've meditated. And I use a number of different tools to meditate. There's breath work, where I just concentrate on my breath work and putting on a timer for about 10 minutes. There's guided meditations, of which there are many apps, but I'm currently using Waking Up by Sam Harris, because I feel the way he guides is distinct to a lot of other meditators and meditation apps. And his neuroscience background really does pull in some of the elements that I feel is lacking in other apps. Not to say that other apps are of lesser quality, that it's really horses for courses. I tend to journal these days, and this brings me on to the next aspect of what I've learned in 2020, the importance of journaling. It is phenomenal. And for those of you who don't know what journaling is, there are a number of different apps and books out there, the 5-Minute Journal, for example. But journaling is literally just writing down your thoughts and affirmations for the day. So my thoughts this morning were, I had a good shift in A&E last night. I spoke to my family, and I'm looking forward to the 24th of Christmas, of 24th of December, where I'm going to be working Christmas Eve, and the guys have planned to bring in lots of food for us and stuff, and have a break if we can during the department. So, you know, those are my top level thoughts. That's literally what I want. And then I write what my affirmations are for the day. So, A, recording this podcast, because I want to get out my learnings from 2020 and share them for whoever might find them useful. B, I need to clear up all my Doctor's Kitchen stuff for the year, because I don't really want to do any more work over the Christmas period and give myself a good break from social media. And the third thing is, I'm going to make sure that I cook myself a really nice lunch, because I had to eat cold dinner, as I usually do, at work yesterday. So, you know, when you focus on getting your morning routine right, the day flows. The mantra from Robin Sharma's book, The 5 AM Club, is own your morning, elevate your life. And that's very, very true. I can't stress this enough. The most successful people in the world all have a morning routine where they get things done really, really early, or at the earliest start of their own day, wherever they woke up. So the rest of the day just flows. And that's my experience over the last 3 months, where I've been waking up quite early, horrifically early for a lot of people, at 5 a.m. to do the dog walking stuff, the meditation, my journaling. It really has allowed me the space to work out everything else that I need to fit into the day, and to prioritize as well about what I put into my day as well. And I've definitely taken a lot more ownership of what I put into my day, because I used to be one that would say yes to everything, and I've learned to say no a lot. And I think we all need to say no a lot more than we're comfortable with. That, combined with journaling, combined with action boarding, which is a practice that I learned about in Tara Swart's book, The Source. It's a different word for vision boarding, because action boarding gives the impetus that things are going to actually happen, and you're going to take actions both consciously and subconsciously to make whatever is on your board come to life. And I've done this process. It's basically where you think about where you want to be in the next year, 5 years, 10 years, however long you want that trajectory to look like, and what you want to achieve. And this goes into my aspirations for the new year with culinary medicine, where we're still aiming to get culinary medicine as a program as part of compulsory medical education in all medical schools. We're working on our online course for practitioners, both medical doctors and nursing as well. And that's something that we're fleshing out this year. We've been working on our food insecurity program with Westminster Kingsway, where we're getting the chefs and culinary students to come up with recipes using typical food bank parcels. And the aspiration to not only teach doctors, but nurses as well. This is something that I think is pivotal to the core mission of culinary medicine, which is elevating the confidence of health practitioners to talk about nutrition with patients in clinical scenarios. Because if you just focus on one aspect, particularly doctors who don't actually have that much contact time with patients in secondary care, you really need to be looking at nursing staff who are just as enthusiastic, who want to learn about nutrition, who believe in the power of nutritional medicine, as they should do, because there is so much evidence behind it. This is really how we scale up this population of health literate and motivated people who are able to take care of themselves using lifestyle measures. And this is something that I'm really galvanized about when it comes to the next year. The other things that I'm looking forward to, the BBC program that I recorded, Thrifty Cooking in the Doctor's Kitchen, the average price of a portion of food, which all contains three portions of fruit, vegetables, nuts or seeds, is 90p. And I just can't wait to show people how that is possible, because it sounds completely unbelievable. It sounds bonkers. But I owe a lot of credit to the Home Economist team, the production team, who really saw the vision and got behind it. And it's going to be one of those programs that hopefully is going to change people's perceptions of food, and how this myth of healthy food being expensive has dominated our thinking. And I want to reframe the culture around that to exemplify just how accessible and easy it can be if you educate people in the right way. If you give them that space and that time to focus on food, then everything else sort of just slots into place as well. And it's really confidence building. So that's definitely something that I'm working on. And the other thing is my app. So I'm creating a Doctor's Kitchen app, which will personalize recipes based on dietary preference, but also nutritional goals. So if you're looking to improve skin, or you're interested in immune health or gut health, or even just trying to live healthier by increasing plant consumption, we are creating a library of hundreds of different recipes, of premium images with step-by-step guides. And the aim is to create a meal planning service where you can meal plan in less than 30 seconds and connect with online supermarkets if you choose to do your shopping online. Or it will create a digital shopping list for you, and you can go and fulfill that shopping list in the normal way. And it will reduce food waste, it will maximize plants in your diet, and it will maximize health benefits as well. And this app is also going to have video content and a whole bunch of other cool features. And I'm super excited, because that's basically what the Doctor's Kitchen is going to become in the future, a resource of recipes that are tailored to your nutrition goals and based on evidence as well. There is so much research that's going in the behind the scenes to come up with dietary sources, dietary patterns, the types of ingredients you should be having in your diet, whether you're looking to optimize fertility or whatever your health goal might be. And also looking at supplementation as well, if that's even necessary, because we're trying to achieve everything through food. And where it's not possible through food, then that's when we talk about supplementation. So yeah, that would be the Doctor's Kitchen app coming soon. If you want to be the first to know about that, then we're going to be shouting about it on the newsletter. But that for me is the one of the biggest goals, and has been one of the biggest goals for the last 2 years. And we've been doing some user testing and some research in the back end. But yeah, that's definitely hopefully where I'm going to be focused on. So that's my roundup of 2020. Obviously, the new book is coming out, 3-2-1. I'm going to do another podcast episode talking about exactly what we mean by 3-2-1 and where the concept came from and why it's going to be so pivotal for people. But gratitude, the realization that tomorrow is not guaranteed, but today is, what I learned during my nutrition master's, inequality and its existence before the pandemic, what I've learned from the podcast, how to live healthier, the power of routine, journaling, action boarding, and my aspirations for the new year. I hope that's been useful in some way, even if it's just a nugget of information about my routine or how I like to process things or my gratitude practice. But if I could give you three things to think about or to practice, it would be just start a gratitude practice every day for 15 days and see how you feel. If you're skeptical of the idea or you've done it before, but perhaps you haven't maintained it, just try again for 15 days, three things that you're grateful for at the end of the day, before you go to bed or when you're having dinner or when you're brushing your teeth or whenever it is, just stick to it for 15 days and see how you feel. The other thing is really look at sugar in the diet. We're going to be doing some other podcasts about this, but examine the sources of sugar in your diet, whether that be from cereals or breads or any snacks that you have in the house or even ready recipes that you might have as a backup. You know, just look at those sources of sugar, condiments, paste sauces, that sort of stuff. A lot of the sugar, the added sugar intake comes from those, let alone juices and drinks and all the other familiar sources of sugar. So really look at that. And the other thing that I would also encourage people to look at are the resources that we put online and on social media about prejudice and sources of unconscious bias. It's subconscious bias. It's pretty amazing how many different ways in which we can be prejudiced. I think we need to admit that to ourselves. I hope you've enjoyed my learnings from 2020. We're going to be continuing with the podcast next year with some fascinating subjects, talking about brain health, mental health, sugar. We have a whole series on nutrition from some of the world's experts and leading authorities in interpreting nutrition science, and a whole bunch of other exciting features as well that I know that everyone's going to love if you've been an avid listener to the podcast already. But this is me, Dr. Rupi Aujla, wishing you a happy festive period and a new year, and I will see you again in the new year.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.